The following is an excerpt from the Science Podcast. To hear the whole show, visit www.sciencemag.org and click on Science Podcast.
Finally today, we have David Grimm, online news editor for Science. He's here to give us a rundown of some of the stories from our daily news site. So, Dave, first up, we have something that I thought would be easy, detecting unconsciousness.
Easy and would give us a bit of peace of mind, especially for those of us who've had surgery. And one of the nightmares is you will somehow wake up during surgery, but still sort of be under. So you'll experience perhaps the terror and the pain of surgery without being able to do anything about it. And believe it or not, about 1 in 1,000 patients actually remembers something from their surgery, even though they're supposed to be completely under anesthesia the entire time.
So right now we test blood pressure and pulse. What other steps could we be doing to prevent that from happening?
Well, researchers have a couple things they rely on. One is something called the BIS index, which is short for the bispectral index. And this is readings from a single electrode connected to a device that calculates a number, which is supposed to give a sense of the patient's brain activity. But that hasn't proved terribly reliable. There's some other methods too, but none of them are 100% foolproof at really predicting when somebody's starting to come out of anesthesia or when at least they're starting to become conscious during surgery.
So this new result is giving us some insight into that. Could you kind of go through their experimental?
Well, what the researchers were looking for here is they were trying to figure out if they could come up with a much more foolproof signature of when somebody was going to come out of anesthesia or become conscious. And what they did was they worked with 3 epilepsy patients who'd had electrodes implanted in their brains in preparation for surgery. And they gave the patients an injection of the anesthetic propofol. And they asked the patients to press a button whenever they heard a tone. And they were recording the activity of their neurons during this whole time. And doing this, they were able to follow a group of neurons that emitted a characteristic slow oscillation, which is a kind of ripple in the cell's electrical field. So they said, well, maybe this is a good signature of whether a patient is conscious. The next step the researchers did was they actually recruited 10 healthy volunteers to actually go under anesthesia, and they used propofol again. But this time they administered the anesthetic really gradually. Usually you fall asleep in just a matter of seconds, but this time it took about an hour for the volunteers to completely go under. And again, they had the volunteers press a button about every 4 seconds in response to clicks or words, including their names, just to see, like, are they responding to stimuli in the environment? Are they somehow conscious? This time they used EEG readings, so they wouldn't actually have to get electrodes into the brain. This could be taken sort of on the scalp. They were sensing very similar activity to what they saw with the epilepsy patients. They saw certain signals that were associated with relaxation, with drowsiness, with increase in consciousness, with loss of consciousness. And so what they think they're developing here is a more accurate warning system that will actually give anesthesiologists a much better sense of whether somebody's starting to come out of anesthesia.
But is this ready for the OR?
Not yet. The main thing is they really haven't done this comprehensively in surgical patients. So they really haven't shown yet whether this will actually be a useful signal in real surgeries. And that's going to require more work.
Great. So next up, we have giant camels that once roamed the Arctic.
Yeah, it's a pretty interesting visual there. We don't really think of camels as living that far north or living in such cold climates. The camels of today tend to be in northern Africa and the interior of Asia. But about 3.5 million years ago, camels appear to have lived in much more northerly latitudes and places that were much colder than the places they live today.
And so what's the evidence for the existence of these guys way up north?
Well, the evidence comes from some fossils that were recovered from Canada's Ellesmere Island, which is just west of northern Greenland. The fossils were discovered in sediment that was laid down about 3.5 million years ago. And what the researchers found was basically fragments of a lower leg bone. Now, they're not exactly sure what animal this came from, at least by looking at the bone itself. But by analyzing proteins in the bone that were still preserved in the bone, they found that the creature was most closely related to today's dromedary camel. That's the camel that just has one hump. But this wasn't really very similar to that camel. For one thing, it was a lot bigger. This camel probably stood about 2.7 meters tall and it was almost 30% larger overall than today's relative.
That's a really big camel.
It's a big camel. It's about the size of a moose. And it probably also had much sort of shaggier fur than today's camels, because even though the Arctic regions 3.5 million years ago were much warmer than they are today, average temperature was only about minus 1.4 degrees centigrade. So it's barely below freezing, not the most comfy of environments, but still about 18 degrees Celsius warmer than that region is today.
Is that where they think the camel originated from, or is it just passing through on its way to Asia?
Well, they think the camel may have actually spent a fair amount of time there. It wasn't just camels. Some other fossils the researchers discovered not too far away suggest that this landscape these camels lived in was actually an open forest punctuated with peatlands, and it may have even been inhabited by bears, rabbits, beavers, and a pony-sized three-toed horse. So this wasn't just sort of like a random camel found in a random place. This was a place where a lot of other mammals were living. And there's some evidence from the teeth of this camel that it was possibly in the process of evolving into something similar to the camels that we see with us today. So an important location and also important time point for this group of animals.
Wow. So last up, we have how volcanoes contribute to modifying global temperatures.
Right. Well, you know, we don't think of volcanoes as really cooling the world, but actually they can, because volcanoes belch a lot of particles into the atmosphere, and these particles block sunlight and actually helps cool the planet a bit. We don't talk a lot about the planet cooling these days because the Earth is warming, but the interesting thing is it's not warming as much as it theoretically should be. For example, between 2000 and 2010, the atmospheric concentration of carbon dioxide, which is one of the major greenhouse gases, rose more than 5%. And if that was the only factor driving climate change, global average temperatures would have risen by about 0.2 degrees Celsius over the last decade. But that's not what happened. So scientists say the reason must be that a lot of these aerosols are getting into the atmosphere that's helping to block sunlight, that's reducing how fast the world is warming.
So there's an opposing force in this case in the form of aerosols, but how do they target volcanoes as the potential source for that?
Right. And actually, a lot of people didn't think it was volcanoes. A lot of scientists thought it was actually pollution from Asian smokestacks. During this period, 2000 to 2010, there was a big ramp up in pollution, not only from Asia, but also from India. And so they said, well, it must be this source. But when the researchers ran a computer model, they found that it didn't seem like these Asian or Indian sources, pollution sources, were really contributing at all to the cooling. In fact, the best signature was really coming from volcanoes.
Now that they've targeted volcanoes, how do they seal the deal? How do they figure out that that actually was the source?
Well, they ran these simulations and they estimated the effects of all the known volcanic eruptions that occurred during this period. And what they found was really that the variations, the timing of what they were seeing in the simulations really matched up very well with volcanoes and not with these particles coming out of smokestacks in Asia and India.
Okay. What else has been on the site this week, Dave?
Well, Sarah, for Science Now, we've got a neuroscience story about how we focus in on a particular conversation at a crowded party. It's called the cocktail party problem. Also a story about transplanting human brain cells into mice and how that makes mice smarter. A couple of interesting stories from Science Insider, our policy blog. One about the continuing impacts of the sequester in the U.S. and scientific research. We're calling it the sequester, and we still have a page up where if you have tales from your own research about how the sequester is impacting your lab, you can share your thoughts. Also use the sequester hashtag on Twitter. We will pick that up. Also a story about the state of science in India and where it's going in the next few years. For Science Live, our weekly chat on the hottest topics in science, this week's Science Live is about open access publishing. How does that stand to change academic publishing in the near future? And next week's Science Live is titled Arts and Smarts, the intersection between culture and science. So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
Sounds great. All right. Thanks so much, Dave.
Thanks, sir.
David Grimm is the editor for Science's online daily news site. You can check out the latest news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org, where you can also join a live chat, Science Live, on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time.